So we're going to talk about traditions. Because there are good traditions. There are traditions that are not so good. And there's some that, as long as they don't get out of hand, not much to worry about. We have traditions here. What you see before you is a form of a tradition. But sadly, we broke the tradition because this is the second Sunday of the month and not the first. My apologies. We have other traditions. We have a tradition where we have treats and coffee in the morning on Sunday at 10 o'clock. I appreciate those. We have a lot of good cooks in this crowd. And as long as you don't overdo it, it shouldn't impact your waistline too much. We have other traditions, a church picnic annually. We go to camp once a year. I really enjoy camp. Don't always get to go, but this year I had an opportunity to go. And the nice thing about it is you can visit with somebody and get to know them, and you're not watching the clock because there's not some appointment or something that's coming up next. I had an occasion to go fishing with someone that I really appreciate, and we had a great time. And we stayed out there until it got too dark to see anymore, and we decided we better head back. That was fun. We have traditions in our homes. We have a tradition at our house, started a long time ago, but I read this book. I read it to my children when they were little. I've read it to my grandchildren. It's called The Best Christmas Pageant Ever. You've probably heard of it. Great little story. And it focuses on a group of children who came from a rather trying circumstances, and they had never heard the Christmas story before. And they wound up being the lead in this Christmas pageant because of some misinformation that they had received. But nonetheless, they were there. And when they were hearing a little bit about what they were supposed to do, it was like, whoa, stop the phone here, or hold the phone here. Tell us the whole story. And so the lady that was leading the pageant goes through the whole story. And because these kids had the reputation of being so awful, the kids who knew them thought, how is it that they understood who the good guys were and who the bad guys were? The first time I heard this story, we were invited out during the Christmas season to some people's houses. It was all adults. We were sitting in the living room after we had something to eat. And we all gathered into the living room, and the lady of the house brought out this book and started reading it, and we all sat there and listened to it. I'd never heard this book before. It was terrific. A tradition was born. When we had kids, as soon as they were able to sit up long enough, I'd read the book. Interesting little story. My youngest daughter, when she was dating her now husband, brought him over Christmas Eve. And after we had had something to eat and we were sitting in the living room, I brought out this book and started reading it. He kind of looked at my daughter Patty and with this look on his face like, what's he doing? Well, he's reading the book. And he looked at her like, all of it? Yeah. But it's been a great tradition, and it gives you an opportunity to tell the story one more time because we seem to need to hear things over and over again. There are some traditions that are not helpful. Jesus talks about traditions. I want to read from you from Matthew 15, verses 1 through 9. Then the scribes and the Pharisees, who were from Jerusalem, came to Jesus saying, "Why do your disciples transgress the traditions of the elders, for they do not wash their hands when they eat?" But he answered them and said, "Why do you also transgress the commandment of God by your tradition? For God commanded, saying, 'Honor your father and mother,' and he who speaks evil of father or mother, let him die the death. But you say, 'Whoever says to his father or mother, whatever you would gain from me, it is a gift,' and in no way he honors his father or his mother, and you voided the commandment of God by your tradition. Hypocrites. Well did Isaiah prophesy of you, saying, 'This people draws near to me with their mouth, but honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. But in vain they worship me, teaching for doctrines the commandments of men.'" The commandments of men. Paul also, as he's talking to the Corinthians, says, "See that no one takes you captive through philosophy or empty deceptions according to the traditions of men." What are traditions? What's a theological tradition? A theological tradition is a doctrine that's believed to have divine authority, though not in the scriptures. Tevye had some ideas about traditions. He held on to traditions that controlled his life. These same traditions controlled the lives of the people in his village. Yet he had no idea where they came from. I have a feeling that these things could have been discovered, but somewhere along the line you have to stop and take a look at traditions. One of my favorite authors, Francis Schaeffer, wrote this book, How Should We Then Live? And he starts out in the very beginning of this book talking about presuppositions. Now, when you think about it, presuppositions, traditions, pretty closely aligned. They have an impact on a person's worldview. And in this book, Schaeffer says, "People have presuppositions, and they will live more consistently on the basis of these presuppositions than they even themselves may realize. By presupposition, we mean the basic way an individual looks at life, his basic worldview." Sound like a tradition? "People's presuppositions lay a grid for all they bring forth into the external world. Their presuppositions also provide the basis for the values and therefore the basis for their decisions." And then he states this, "As a man thinketh, so is he." Any thoughts where that came from? It's out of Proverbs 23:7. But it's true. As we think in our heart, so are we. And the things that we believe impact the way we act, the way we think, and the way that we live our life. So, it's important for us to examine our presuppositions, our traditions, to see if they are of God or of men. In the New Testament, we find that any tradition of God is enumerated in this book. So we can check them. So if we have a tradition, like reading this book, for example, or having communion on the first Sunday of the month, the Bible really doesn't speak to that. We could have had it on the second Sunday of the month every month. Doesn't matter. The idea is that we do it in remembrance when we talk about the traditions of God, Paul talks about in Corinthians, how I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you. Where do the traditions of God come from? Well, in the first century, they came from the believers, from the apostles, from the people who were eyewitnesses to the death and the resurrection and all of the teachings of the Lord Jesus. In 2 Corinthians 3:6, Paul says again, according to the traditions which you received from us. And after all of the eyewitnesses had passed on, we still had their writings, which became the New Testament and the Old Testament. Well, let's take a look at some of the things that Jesus taught about traditions and how the next generation of those who would be leading the church, his disciples, should act. There's a very interesting account in Mark chapter 10, verse 35 through 45. Picture this, they're all together at a meal. James and John, sons of Zebedee, came to him saying, Master, we desire that you should do for us whatever we ask. You know, I've had my kids say that to me when they were little bitty. Dad, we want you to do something for us. What? Well, we just want you to do it for us, whatever we ask. You know, I caught a whiff of a skunk in a woodpile when I heard that. I got a feeling Jesus probably did too. And then he said to them, what do you desire that I should do for you? And they said to him, grant to us that we may sit one on your right side and one on your left, right hand and one on your left hand in your glory. These must have been the younger of the disciples that were asking that. And Jesus said to them, you don't know what you're asking. Can you drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said to him, oh, we can. And Jesus said to them, you shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of. And with the baptism that I am baptized with, you shall be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give, but to those for whom it's prepared. And when the 10 heard, they began to be indignant with James and John. But Jesus called them and said to them, you know that they who are accounted rulers over the nations exercise lordship over them, and their great ones exercise authority on them. But it shall not be so among you. For whosoever desires to be great among you, let him be your servant. Whosoever of you desires to become first, he shall be servant of all. For even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life a ransom for many. Think about that. The Creator of the universe. The greatest servant. And he demonstrated it when he washed the disciples' feet. It was the lowest job of a slave in the household. And the Creator of the universe is doing that? If you recall from the story, Peter says, you can't do that. Peter, you don't get it. This is what leadership is about, serving. You must do this. If you're coming into this thinking that you're going to gain some prestige from whatever position this is, you're wrong. You don't understand. The example that Jesus set is servant first. Try this one on. In Matthew 23, 8 through 12, Jesus is talking to his disciples. You must not be called rabbi, for one is your teacher, Christ, and you are all brothers. And call no one your father on earth, for you have your father in heaven. Nor be called teachers, for one is your teacher, even Christ. But he who is greatest among you shall be your servant, and whosoever shall exalt himself shall be abased, and he who shall humble himself shall be exalted. We in the church like to use a title, pastor. It's kind of interesting to note the word pastor. It actually exists in the New Testament, but it's in Greek, of course, since that's what the book was written in, and it's poime, poime. Now, it's in the New Testament 18 different times. Out of those 18 different times that Greek word is used, one time it's used as pastor, and the rest of the times it's always rendered shepherd. For example, in Matthew 9:36, but when he saw the multitude, Jesus, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Same Greek word, poime. In Matthew 25:32, and before him shall be gathered all nations, and he shall separate them one from another, as a shepherd divideth his sheep from the goats. Same word, poime. And I've got a whole list of these things here, but I'm going to jump down. In Luke, in the beginning of Luke, we see the story of the birth of Jesus Christ, and the shepherds are in the field. Same word. Those were shepherd, taking care of sheep. In John 10:12, but he that is a hireling and not the shepherd, same word, whose own the sheep are not, seeth the wolf coming and leaveth the sheep and fleeth, and the wolf catches them and scatters the sheep. And again, Jesus said, I am the good shepherd, and know my sheep, and am known of thine, of mine. So, the only time that that word is used in the New Testament, and it shows up singular, and it speaks of the chief shepherd, it's talking about Jesus Christ. It's in 1 Peter 5:4. And it says this, and when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. So this word poime, this idea of pastor or the chief of the shepherds, belongs to only one individual. And that's Jesus the Christ. The understanding here is all of us who serve into some sort of pastoral responsibility or teaching responsibility are mere under shepherds underneath the chief shepherd, who is Jesus. That's the biblical tradition. Someone might say, well, for us to have someone leading the church, they have to go to seminary and they have to do all of this training and so on and so forth. I've often thought when I've heard that, what did people do in the first century? There were no such things. These people were taught in the context of the local church. The leadership was raised up within the body. I wanted to introduce you to a man who was born in 1851. That was a few years before the Civil War began. He was the son of a slave and a free woman. When he was 4 years old, his mother passed away. A year later, he was put to work. They didn't have child labor laws back in those days. So someone who was 5, 6, 7, 8 years old might be working somewhere. And this man, his name was Charles Tinley, probably was a pretty big boy because when he became a man, he was 6'3", a very imposing figure. But he had it in his mind and on his heart that he should educate, be educated. He taught himself how to read and write. By the time he was 17 years old, he was part of a church, and he sought instruction from the church. He wanted to learn Hebrew, and so he found a rabbi in a synagogue, and he taught him Hebrew. He was a man who wanted to be a disciple of Jesus Christ and found people who would teach him. He eventually became a deacon, and then an elder, and then an itinerant minister, and traveled around the country preaching the gospel. He was also a hymn writer. And the song that we're going to sing at the end of the service, he wrote. See, we are brothers and sisters. There is no one above anyone else. We're all the same. And there is one chief pastor, and that's Jesus. Here's the point. However we operate this church, it needs to be operated in a way that it supports that which is the mission of the church. You've heard me say this before. The mission of the church is what Jesus told us to do before he left town. You will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, in Judea, Samaria. To the uttermost part of the earth. And then he said, go therefore and make disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. That's our job. We all have different talents that we use to contribute to this effort. And next week, we'll hear some of that. But don't be confused about what the biblical tradition for what we are supposed to do is about. It's about making disciples. I just thought that Charles Tinley seemed to be an excellent example of one who sought to be a disciple and sought to preach the gospel so that he might continue in what we were told to do. Let that be our mission here at Grace Life Church, that we are an outpost where disciples are made so that we might impact the world, at least starting right here at Anoka.